But I think what is overlooked, and I think is consciously overlooked in our era, is that before that power could be distributed in a useful way, it had to be massively, massively consolidated.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
So, Rob, how have you been this week?
No real complaints. You know, I visited the Catskills for the first time. I'd never been, despite being born in New York City and growing up in its environs, I had never made it to upstate New York, really. Never made it any further north than Westchester. And it's a whole thing up there.
I've never heard that term. What is that, Catskills?
The Catskills are some mountains that were very famous in the mid-20th century for hosting predominantly Jewish resorts, because Jews were barred from other kinds of resorts up until the mid-20th century. And it's really important for, like, the birth of stand-up comedy. A lot of entertainment of the 20th century still tremendously influential today, like, sort of got its start up there. So I went up and saw a museum up there, or the beginnings of a museum up there. It was very interesting.
Brilliant. I'll maybe cut this bit out, but I think it's very important that we do incredibly up-to-date and recent topics, because a lot's been happening in the news. So I'll maybe get to work straight after this and we can get it out fresh for Monday.
It's so important. This is what we're doing today is absolute cutting-edge stuff. Really, like it's so fresh and so likely to be countermanded that it's important that we get this out as soon as possible.
Okay. So what are you going to do this time, Rob?
Today we're talking about Henry VIII.
Oh.
He was an English king that reigned between 1509 and 1547.
Okay. Could you tell us what brought him to power, or what do you think so important about him?
Well, Henry VIII is the second of the Tudor monarchs. This is a particularly significant group or ruling family for England, and later on they also had a lot of claims to Ireland, and they actually engineered a degree of unity after Elizabeth I died childless, a degree of unity between England and Scotland, which we'll maybe talk about next episode. They are tremendously significant because Henry VIII is so interesting. And he was a monster, to be quite clear. This is truly a monstrous individual, and sort of a famous fail son, actually. Henry VII, a character we don't hear much about, is one of the most successful adventurers in history. Despite having a very tenuous claim to the English throne, he was able to take the country in 1485, mostly because everybody in the country was so sick of the endless civil wars that they didn't really care that this somewhat tenuous fella had taken the throne. And with the 20-odd years that he was in power, he set up this, he just seemed to be extraordinarily good at his job, managed to make the English throne wealthy in ways that just simply didn't happen, built up this massive, massive treasury. And it seemed
well,
that he was—
Well, it's considered that the people that won the War of the Roses was Wales, because the Tudors originate from Wales, and the losers was Ireland.
Well, that is unquestionable. That is unquestionable. And I haven't done as much research on the Tudors' interactions with Ireland, but things were always bad between the kings of England and Ireland. But things got a lot worse with the Tudor switch in religion. So I think Henry VIII specifically is most famous for his six wives. He murdered two of them. He divorced a few. One survived. And the pop cultural imprint of Henry VIII before this is massive. There's the television show The Tudors, which ran fairly successfully in the last decade. There's a Broadway show right now downtown.
Wow!
I think it's about. I think it's very tangentially related, and it's my sense from the advertising material is that it puts a more feminist swing on things. But it is nominally about Henry VIII's six wives.
You could also argue Game of Thrones with Robert Baratheon's a bit of sort of Henry the Seventh and Eighth combined.
Oh, no question.
Because Henry VIII didn't, you know, win his throne through conquering, which his father did do, and Robert Baratheon, you know, won the rebellion and then lived out his entire life as king and became quite overweight and decrepit as he got older.
Yes, there's some very real parallels, some very real parallels. But what's also interesting is I think, if I recall correctly, it's been a while since I watched and read Game of Thrones, but there is a sort of Robert Baratheon, doesn't he have a son named Renly who's just lovely and everybody loves him and he's the flower of chivalry and da, 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 da. That's actually what Henry VIII was for the first decade when he was of his reign.
Before he was to be king, he was the backup.
Well, yes, he was certainly the backup, but also he was
the heir and the spare, I think's the term.
Yes. But he was famously just sort of lovely. You know, Henry VII had two sons, as you mentioned. One of them died. But Henry was just sort of seen as this glorious idea of what a king should be. I mean, Henry VII was sort of a, you look at the famously his portrait, he looks a bit shifty, you know?
Yeah, gaunt.
Yes. This is a guy who looks like he calculated and worked very hard to be as successful as he was, whereas Henry VIII was this grand, you know, chivalrous fella. And for a decade or so, I think two decades, he was more or less happily married to Catherine of Aragon. And then he eventually just, you know, she did not produce a male heir, and he was driven a bit insane by that. But anyway, so the wives, you know, we've got the TV shows. I'm just finishing this extraordinary trilogy of books by Hilary Mantel, focusing on Thomas Cromwell, one of Henry VIII's advisors, who's tremendously significant. Wolf Hall was an amazing television show I would highly recommend. I've been trying to watch The Tudors a bit to prepare for this, and man, like, Wolf Hall is like 15 cuts above that as far as an entertainment piece. But what I want to argue today, and the reason that I'm bringing up Henry VIII, is because I think that Henry VIII specifically and the Tudors more generally, despite their massive cultural imprint, are kind of undersold as shaping the British Empire, the world we live in today. I think they were tremendously significant in ways that aren't emphasized enough. And I think specifically by talking about Henry VIII and his relation to religion, I hope to tease out the ways that Henry VIII was a pioneer, a sort of Prometheus even, in terms of modernization and the way that he consolidated government in the United Kingdom changed things dramatically, hyper-modern in a way. I think that he forced, not very successfully, you know, his children had to pick up the pieces afterwards, but he forced a transition in the 1530s that it took France until the 1790s to go through, or that Ataturk in Turkey is famous for forcing Turkey through in the 1920s. So Britain has many, many advantages that ended up yielding its miraculous control of the entire world in the 19th century. Of course, there's the coal deposits, there's the capitalism, there's the this, that, and the other thing. First and foremost, most important, and this is how I put it in my book, Avoiding the British Empire, was geography, just the degree of peace and quiet that they were able to have because, well, after sort of amphibious attacks became more difficult after the Viking era, after they figured out how to harden themselves from raiding. And it became tremendously difficult, famously after 1066, for anybody to conquer Britain. But that's not enough. You can't just have amazing geography in your benefit. The choices need to be made that take advantage of that geography. And Henry VIII, for the worst and most selfish reasons imaginable, made that choice. And I think set the United Kingdom, Britain, England, it's all very confusing, and we're dealing with a time period where all of those things either didn't exist yet or meant different things. But his choices and the sometimes very successful patchwork done by Elizabeth I in particular, really formed the history of the British Empire and informed the world history that we're all living in today. And that's why I wanted to talk about Henry VIII a bit today and sort of give him his due.
Do you believe a lot of the hype? It seemed to be when he was young, it was like, oh, he's so athletic, he's so intelligent, he's such a good scholar, he loves Catholicism. Do you believe all this, or how much do you think is hyperbolic?
I think obviously it's hyperbolic. You know, he couldn't have been as fantastic as the courtiers' letters claim he was. But you don't have that degree of hagiography and worshipfulness about every king of England. You know, in part perhaps it's a testament to just how well Henry VII set him up. In part, it's a lot of actors in the Tudor court were really, really keen to establish legitimacy because the Tudors were so illegitimate. So they you know, he certainly was in his youth very athletic, but they, you know, wanted to sell that more and more to emphasize his regal bearing and his so of course it's all public relations. But it does seem like there's a pretty well attested that he was first a massive, impressive athlete, and then was always a imposing and regal figure. In some ways, he's sort of the vision of an English king that comes to mind. And he really is, which is interesting because he shattered a lot of definitions of what an English monarch should be. And in so doing, created the ferment that led to a lot of what came after. We emphasize a lot 1689 in the history of Britain, England, the United Kingdom, what have you. I mean, I should have just given myself a primer refresh for 10 minutes before I embarked on this. I apologize if you're cringing every time I misuse the language here, right? But we emphasize a lot how Parliament took power from the king and then allowed this incredible capitalist and industrialist rebirth. And that was very important. But I think what is overlooked, and I think is consciously overlooked in our era, is that before that power could be distributed in a useful way, it had to be massively, massively consolidated. And I would argue that Henry VIII is probably the most powerful English monarch there has ever been. Yet that power, that power that he consolidated, set the stage for English monarchs to be stripped of power 150 years later. Directly 100 years after his reign, Charles I lost his head, and then 40 years after that, we sort of arrived at the understanding that more or less still governs the United Kingdom today between monarch and parliament. But I don't think that all that range of development, that 100, 150 years of creating the first modern form of representative government, at least on a mass level, that we have in the United Kingdom, I don't think any of that would have been possible without the incredible consolidation of power that Henry VIII put in place.
I believe what also got things really going was seeing all these incredibly rich Spaniards with their big fancy boats, and they kind of thought it'd be nice to get in on that action.
For sure. I mean, in his own way, Charles V and his predecessors and successors, that's the Holy Roman Emperor, who was also in charge of Spain, who actually divvied up after himself because he realized how unmanageable it was also a tremendously powerful figure that changed many things in many ways. But what I think one really interesting aspect of Henry VIII is that despite his incredible local power, his incredible consolidation of money and wealth and spiritual and political power in his own person, was one of the weakest English monarchs on the world stage. He because of his durability, he was able to converse, you know, to be seen as something of a lesser equal on the European stage and then sort of be a fixed position in European politics. But wow, was the UK less of a power than it was 100 years later? Well, 200 years later, and certainly much less of a power than it was 100 years before. So the Tudor realm, despite how well remembered they are, I mean, these were folks who were running scared most of the time. I mean, Queen Elizabeth's most glorious accomplishment, which far outpaces anything that Henry VIII managed, was seeing off a massive Spanish invasion of England. That sort of Spanish Armada, I think the 1580s or something along those lines. So just surviving was what the Tudors managed to accomplish on the world stage. But what they did internal to England, and unfortunately also to Ireland and to the state of relations with Scotland, was tremendously important for what came after. I do want to just a bit of quick situating ourselves in history here.
So there's only three Tudors, essentially, you could argue.
Well, there's definitely, there's Henry the Seventh, Henry the Eighth, Edward the Sixth, I believe, Bloody Mary, Elizabeth the First. So that's a solid five. There's poor Lady Grangey in the middle there, who was, I think, queen for 9 days before being executed because the Protestants wanted to hold on to control. But just to situate ourselves historically here a bit, because I know not everybody is as nerdy about European history as we are. The 1400s, we're in, and I put this in my book, Avoiding the British Empire, just this incredibly fast shift by historical standards of really over the course of like 400 years, we go from full-on medieval to modernity and Britain controlling the whole world. And that's a tremendous, tremendous transition. So in the 1400s, that's actually, we mentioned Game of Thrones earlier, one of the principal models for Game of Thrones. There's tons of stuff thrown in there from everywhere, of course. But one of the principal models is the Wars of the Roses, the wars of the 1400s over the succession to the English throne that Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII, settled in 1485. So in the 1400s, we've got like the very like ideal of knights in shining armor beating the crap out of each other, dukes and kings and, you know, the sort of what you imagine if you imagine like medieval times or what have you. And there's certainly problematic things about the popular imagination there, but really, and things were of course massively different than they were 500 or 1,000 years before in England, but the terms of the political argument and the aspects, most importantly, the role of the church, would have seemed familiar. Very, very different from 500 years or 1,000 years before, but familiar in important ways. 200 years later, in the mid-1600s, we've got what many can see as sort of one of the first modern revolutions. Mike Duncan's Revolutions podcast, you might be familiar with, highly recommended if you're not. He starts off his analysis of revolutions with the English Civil War, ending with the Russian Revolution. So it's like the first in the 20th century. So it's sort of like the first modern revolution. And Oliver Cromwell is probably, I would argue, the first modern dictator. The truly like just sort of set the, before people talked about Hitler, they talked about Napoleon. Oh, we don't want another Napoleon. And before Napoleon, they talked about Cromwell. We don't want another Cromwell. So to go from medieval times to the first modern revolution and civil wars and dictators in just 200 years time, and then 200 years later, we're essentially in the modern world. You know, in the 1800s, Britain controls everything, and the main concerns are like the interest rate that governments pay on their debt or what have you. You know, we've just this incredible transition that we've made. And it is not, as I think a lot of sort of Whig history or what have you, we would tell you just, the important thing was the English Civil War and then 40 years later, the Glorious Revolution, English Civil War in the 1640s, 40 years later, 1689, that's the most important thing. That transition from literally Game of Thrones to a modern revolutionary context with like, even in the 1600s, Britain had the first embryo of a central bank, embryo of very late 1600s, embryo of a national debt, like that sorts of thing, those sorts of things. Henry VIII and the Tudors more broadly and Henry VIII specifically is vital in that transition. And that's why I wanted to talk about Henry VIII today, not about his wives or what have you.
This talk of him being a nice person to begin with and then ending up horrendous, it seems to be he treated his first wife as well as could be expected.
It doesn't seem like they had an unhappy marriage. It doesn't by the standards of the time.
Yes,
to be clear, like he was absolutely by the standards of the time for a king is a whole nother level. I mean, he was
kings could do whatever they wanted, and it seemed like if queens did anything out of line, they would very often die.
Yeah, not as often as with Henry VIII, though. Like you'd have to step pretty far out of line, and Henry VIII killing two of his six wives is quite horrific, even by the standards of the day. But in those 20 years of marriage or 15 years of marriage prior to his discarding Catherine, it does seem that, you know, I mean, this was a storyline on the Tudors episode I was watching, but I believe is also historically documented that he like knocked up like her chambermaids and stuff.
Yes,
like that.
Yes, he did have a son, Fitzroy.
Yes. Yeah. Who died as a teenager, but was the only real son that
we know of.
No, well, Edward VI, of course, but like he the only son that he would have known as most of an adult or something like that, but he was illegitimate. So I guess we should be grateful to how monstrous Henry VIII was in terms of his marital relations, because it does keep this era of history front and center. And as annoying as it can be for like, oh, I'm a politics guy and I don't really want to talk about, you know, marriages and horseshit like that, it is accurate that the sexual relations, the marital relations of the king were tremendously important in how things shook out. Henry VIII had two principal advisors. Again, he has this massively long reign. Another incredible gift England, I guess, has gotten is that, but that continued until the era of Great Britain and the United Kingdom, was after many, many periods of instability, in between periods of massive instability, they've been blessed with an extraordinary succession of long-lived monarchs. Which I don't think anybody else can point to that consistency. You've got Edward I and Edward III, I think both reigned for like a close to 50 years or more than 50 years. Those kings were spectacularly long-lived. The whole era of the Tudors, yeah, there were five or six Tudor kings, Tudor monarchs, but really two of them have almost a century between them. Henry VIII between 1509 and 1647, and I believe Elizabeth I from the 1560s up until 1603 or thereabouts. So tremendously long lived. It's a real, and over the period that Henry VIII was in power, he had two main advisors, really, Cardinal Wolsey and then Thomas Cromwell were his two main guys, two great consternation of the nobility of Britain, and that had some really serious effects, because both Cardinal Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell were commoners, but both Thomas Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell lost their positions and their lives over Henry VIII's wives. Cardinal Wolsey, who is described, I guess, I'm not sure if it's entirely fair, but in Geoffrey Moorhouse's book on the Pilgrimage of Grace, is described as essentially ruling the country from 1515 to 1530 or thereabouts, lost his power because he could not secure the divorce that Henry VIII so wanted from his first wife. Thomas Cromwell was able to secure that divorce, was also able to aid Henry VIII in the execution of the next wife, Anne Boleyn, when that became what happened. And then was part of the process that put Jane Seymour in his way, that Jane Seymour is the woman who actually did finally give him a son and heir, Edward VI. Jane Seymour died, I think, roughly 2 weeks after giving birth to Edward VI, followed by... So anyway, and then after the death of Jane Seymour, Thomas Cromwell attempted to secure a Protestant bride from Germany for Henry VIII. This bride was famously unsatisfactory to Henry VIII, and that played a part in his fall.
But he was
his execution.
He was quite old and decrepit at this point, would that be right?
Oh yeah, he was old and decrepit, but he still had two more wives to go after he dispatched the
fourth
one.
So she would have been Lutheran at this point.
That's tremendously complicated, and I think that gets into the religious aspects of You know, was she Lutheran, or was she simply, or was her Cleves, you know, the particular jurisdiction that she was from, just more interested in asserting independence from the Holy Roman Emperor and from the Pope? That is a tremendously complicated question. Perhaps you can Google it and see if Anne of Cleves was Lutheran. But I think that was it's just a very interesting, debatable question that I wouldn't, that would have us here for maybe 3 hours, and I'm not up on enough to talk about.
Because Lutheranism wasn't popular in England. It was like its own form of Christianity.
Well, so what Martin Luther did was say that certain activities by the Catholic Church and by the Pope are inappropriate. He was condemned for that and then went a little more extreme. I don't have the details of doctrine in front of me, but I believe he was against popes and the church itself going forward. Martin Luther was very interested in being the leader of Protestantism or what have you, and saying, this is the new way we're going to do things. Everybody should do things this way. But other folks very quickly started having different ideas. There was a bunch of Swiss theologians. I think Ulrich Zwingli sticks in my mind. And then a couple decades or maybe a half century later, John Calvin comes on the scene, who was tremendously influential. So this incredible ferment, and the Church of England sort of always cut its own path in this ferment. Henry VIII, I think to his dying day, would have maintained that he was a good Catholic. It was simply that the Pope was wrong, and that it was only right for the king to be in charge of the church. It's quius reino, quius religio? I don't know. There's some Latin phrase that briefly settled these issues in the Holy Roman Empire in the 1500s. That's a key point. This later became about serious disputes of religious doctrine. And Henry VIII just wanted a divorce. He liked masses. He liked the ceremony. But he was also, and this is key, he was also really, really greedy. So he was able to be convinced by potentially, they were dissembling at the time. I think it's very, very clear that Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury through the end of Henry VIII's time and through Edward VI, was a very committed Protestant. I think it's a little more up in the air how committed Thomas Cromwell was to Protestantism. Regardless, these men and other men were able to convince Henry VIII that monasticism and the tremendously wealthy possessions owned by the church were not justly owned by the church. These men were motivated by strongly Protestant views. Henry VIII just wanted the money and saw himself as, you know, to his dying day, wanted to practice the religion.
Because at this time, the Catholic Church was all about the bling.
I think that is a very fair characterization.
Because I heard a great way to ruin a lot of films is if they're medieval and they'll show a church and it'll look like an old barn, and you're like, this would have been plastered in gold. It would have been so gaudy and over the top. And I think Henry VIII liked the look of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you think about just the extraordinary complexity and impressiveness of a medieval parish church, let alone a cathedral, but you compare the structures that were built everywhere other than churches up until the 19th century, just imagine the amount of money you'd have to be to raise even a normal parish church as a medieval dirt farmer. I mean, the incredible dedication.
Well, they would have almost seemed like spaceships, because they just seem so alien and so engineered compared to anything else at the time.
Exactly. And they became symbols of local pride. They became symbols. And that's the world, I think, that Henry VIII changed. And I think that's the really vital point here, is what Britain was like, what England was like, what became the United Kingdom was like, what all of Europe was like. And actually, and this is a video that had better be published by the time this gets out, sort of called how, like, you know, Western civilization is big government. I was just sort of shocked reading about some authors like Janet Abu-Lagod and Aisha Zerikol writing these books about just sort of how the world worked in a very basic sense prior to the advent of European hegemony. And I was really struck how outside of China, China had some different things going on, but outside of China, how similar the world looked from across Eurasia. In Europe, in the Middle East, in India, Central Asia, you had these very real, very different from religion to religion, of course, but very real divisions between political and religious power. All of them were intertwined in different ways. I'm sure you could find like a Indian statelet where it's like, oh, well, that looks exactly like modern Germany or something, according to some, you know, but this is in the aggregate. It was shocking to me just how separate the religious, political, and cultural powers were in all of these societies. Probably Protestant-leaning men that worked for Henry VIII so very strongly argued that the religious aspect was vastly more wealthy than the political aspect, and that was not the way that things should be. There's actually an estimate, this was again from the Geoffrey Morehouse book, and it's a Geoffrey Morehouse book repeating the propaganda of the guys who wanted to break up the monasteries. So maybe this is not, you know, this.
Well, that's always the difficult thing with history is whose propaganda are you believing?
Exactly. But the estimate of Thomas Cromwell's men was that while the government of Britain at that point had an annual revenue to play with of about £100,000 a year, obviously money.
Not adjusted for inflation.
Yes, that is not adjusted for inflation. The government had about £100,000 a year of income to play with. The church had £300,000 of income. And another aspect of this, of course, that is very important for Henry VIII, is that also political power was separate and disparate in ways in the sort of feudal era that was dying. And of course, that interplayed with religion as well. And that had a lot to do with why Henry VIII loved his low-born advisors like Cardinal Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell, because they weren't wrapped into these ancient rival centers of power. But the church made so much more money than the English government did every year. And that was kind of crazy, or these men saw that as kind of crazy. And of course, their language was suffused with harping on very real corruption, monks and dissolute monks and this, that, and the other thing. This book, the Morehouse book, says that sort of the seriousness of religious calling had been waning for decades, if not a century or so, and that made their job easier. But it was a truly, truly revolutionary choice to break up the monasteries. And the monasteries didn't just, you know, they had a massive income. These incomes were based much more strongly on land in this pre-industrial era. And the reason that the church had such a larger income is because they owned so much more property than the government did.
Isn't that one of the reasons why priests, they didn't want to marry? Because they would then pass down the church's land and divide it up. So a way of stopping that was to not let priests have children.
Well, I'd never thought of that, but yeah, that makes a ton of sense. That makes a ton of sense. So the church, massive, massive landowner, and this is the case. It's fascinating in Turkey today. There's still vakifs, which is sort of foundations that own and operate mosques that also own businesses around. That was something that the Turkish government was very against for a very long time, and now the Turkish government's a little more interested in giving them a freer hand. But, you know, vakif or foundation or that just sort of controls a piece of religious property and uses it to control local economies, build sources of wealth. That was a very established dynamic across the Muslim world as well. So this is what was going on everywhere. And in this weird North Atlantic island that already had a bunch of weird privileges and changes, they decided we're not going to have that happen anymore. And to be clear, Henry VIII was by no means the only medieval or Renaissance monarch that chafed under the control of the church or wanted to exert more power, but he's the one that was able to get away with it. He's the one that was able to get away with it most comprehensively because he lived on an island. You know, I mean, like I can't emphasize enough just how important geography has been to the rise of the British Empire and how important geography is to the current hegemony of the United States. It's incredibly important. But also these very contingent factors. The fact that this guy was a monster and wanted to, you know, was incredibly greedy and incredibly violent, coupled with new religious ideas that were coming out of Germany starting in 1517.
Adapting these ideas, not just taking them wholesale, just going, we like bits of that. We like the bit where we keep all the money.
Well, so Henry VIII's children, which we'll get to in the next episode, were Edward VI, his son, went whole hog. Well, the advisors surrounding him. He, I think, reigned for about 6 years from the age of like, I think he died as a teenager. I think he started, he either died as a teenager or in his early 20s. Had a very brief reign, mostly under regents. But under that reign was the most Protestant that England has ever been. And it has never been that Protestant since. famously, the Anglican Church is as close as you can get to the Catholic Church without the Pope.
Yeah, that's what you hear. It's not too far removed.
Well, I grew up in an Anglican church. We call it Episcopalian in the United States, but it's basically, it's two everything buts away from the Pope. It's everything but the Pope, and then it's everything but the King after the American Revolution. And yeah, it's smells and bells, they call it. You know, they not so big on the incense, but we're big on the bells and the stained glass and the gaudy, the gaudiness and the ceremony. and some of that is actually 19th century innovations in the Anglican Church, like maybe in the 1700s, certainly in some places, even the Anglican Church, not dissenters, would be a little more Protestant seeming, but it was never more Protestant than it was in the reign of Edward VI, his son. But even then, because it is not a Protestant idea generally that the monarch should,
the divine right of kings.
That the monarch should be the head of the church. I don't know even, I'm not sure what Lutheran theology is on that, but it has been very solidly the case from Henry VIII Tudors down to today that the monarch is the head of the church. Charles III, which is just an insane, just a sidebar, like why the hell would you name yourself, why would you name your kid Charles? And why would you hold on to Charles as King of England? Like Charles is the name Charles so far for kings is, I think, two for two. No, I guess Charles II was not violently overthrown, but his brother who took power after him was. So it is not an auspicious name for a monarch. The Charles I got his head cut off during the English Civil War, and his son, Charles II, who was in, you know, did come back to power, restored monarchy, and, you know, put together a reign that was only a dynasty that only survived for 5 years after him. Sorry?
What I heard during the coronation is he's sort of rejuvenating the name. He will make it a much more triumphant name and fix its besmirched history.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane because it's like getting your head cut off. And I think famously Charles II, like, died morbidly obese or like he's just like
living the dream.
Yeah. It seems like Restoration London, Charles, the London of Charles II would have been a lot of fun. It was last days of disco, last days of Rome, just like incredibly debauched. But again, it's not something you'd aim for anyway, whatever. Charles III. Anyway. Yeah, the last king of England, hopefully.
But wasn't he particularly brutal and destroyed a lot of cathedrals and monasteries?
This is Henry VIII.
Yes.
So what he wanted was money. And it's fascinating, just I've read a fair amount. This guy, Geoffrey Moorhouse, is really valuable. I think he's since passed, but in the late 20th century did some really valuable sort of excavation work. He's written this book on the Pilgrimage of Grace, and he's written the experience of the dissolution of the monasteries from the perspective of one of the cathedrals. So much of the property in the United Kingdom, in England, was owned...
England, Wales, and Ireland.
Under Henry VIII.
Under Henry VIII.
Yes, that makes sense. So this guy, Geoffrey Moorhouse, has done some really valuable work just looking into the 1530s and how crazy that was. What an absurd revolution took place there. Cromwell and his advisors, who became some of the most phenomenally wealthy people in English history, because of course back then it was expected that you'd cream a little off the top. There's actually a historical figure called Richard Rich. Richie Rich is I think a comic book character, or a cartoon character, but there actually is a historical figure named Richard Rich, who was another jumped up lawyer under Cromwell. And yeah, one of the most wealthy people in English history, because he was taking the lead under Cromwell, and I think after Cromwell as well, in the dissolution of these monasteries. And they started out carefully. They were like, well, we're just going to go after the small houses that are dying out anyway and take all their lands. And apparently they were pretty good about giving pensions to monks and nuns and this sort of thing. And then a year or so later, in the mid to late 1530s, they started going after the big ones. And some of them that were cathedral houses, you know, were preserved as cathedrals, but the religious life around it was broken up, and the land holdings were broken up and absorbed by the crown. Just briefly on Henry the Seventh was this just guy out of nowhere, phenomenal manager who managed to make the English crown tremendously wealthy. Something that English monarchs have always hated is that even since the 1300s, they've been obligated to go get money from parliaments. Henry the Seventh is one of the few guys who just managed his revenues really well and probably murdered and disappropriated the right people enough that he left a massive, well-funded treasury to his son, Henry the Eighth. Henry the Eighth was in part able to look so grand and regal and the flower of chivalry because he just fire hosed all of that money away. He really did just, pointless wars against France. There's this, I think 1520, there was this absurdly expensive Field of the Cloth of Gold sort of diplomatic mission to France where he and the French king wrestled. And it's, you know, just this beautiful, people love to talk about it even 500 years later, but it was just ruinously expensive. So what Henry VIII managed to do was piss away all the money that his father had put together in a very short period of time. So going after the monasteries, despite the fact that he mostly just wanted a divorce, he was also incredibly greedy. So that is why all these monasteries were broken up. And the impact, even if he didn't want to be a big religious reformer, famously in his earlier life, he'd written a massive tract condemning Martin Luther and got the title Defender of the Faith from the Pope that I think Charles III is still using now.
He's seen himself as a very good Catholic boy.
Exactly. But he really needed money. And these guys, these probably more Protestant-leaning guys, gave him potential to get money. And what's important here, and what struck me the most about just the significance of it, is that this is a process that every country has had to engage in every country, European and otherwise, if it wants to truly be a power of any note in the world. And what's fascinating is that the UK did in the 1530s, this process of breaking up the monasteries, taking all this money from the church, that it did in the 1530s, really the rest of Europe didn't pull off until like the 1790s or later. It is extraordinary how late the rest of Europe came to this approach to things. Of course, the French monarchy had a lot more power to exert over the church. You know, in the 1300s, they like had their own pope for a little while. But the general like just cleaning out of the monasteries in a short period of time. This was stuff that the enlightened, you know, and it was before the French Revolution as well. Some of the famous enlightened despots in Austria-Hungary and elsewhere carried out some of this. And Peter the Great in Russia was famous for cutting people's beards. And I believe, was he the one who like created the old believer schism by changing the Greek Orthodox liturgy or what have you? I could be conflating different things. But regardless, Peter the Great, that's 150 years after. Almost everything everybody ended up doing what Henry VIII did. But they did it 150, 250, 400 years later. It's fascinating just comparing Henry VIII to Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founding father of the Turkish Republic in the early 20th century. It's obviously very different in many, many, many different ways. Atatürk is a much more worthwhile figure than Henry VIII. But the same consolidation of government power over religion that Henry VIII was doing literally 400 years earlier.
And do you see this pattern with ancient civilizations?
Oh, well, that's a great question that I absolutely don't have the answer to. I mean, obviously the dynamics of religious evolution in Rome, arriving at Christianity are massively argued over, but I can't come to a great parallel there. But just that consolidation, just tremendously significant. And what's interesting is that it had similar effects in all of these different eras. I think that in terms of truly pushing religion out of French government, like that was an accomplishment of the French Revolution in the 1790s. And it had similar repercussions. This book by Geoffrey Moorhouse, which I've only made it a third of the way through, but I'm really, really interested in enjoying, is about the Pilgrimage of Grace, which was the most serious revolt that the Tudors ever faced, which was a massive northern rising in defense of their churches, in defense of I'm not sure if it was explicitly, their monks or what have you, but it was to stop this, what they saw as pillaging of their churches. It's actually also figures in this work of fiction as well. But Henry VIII had to give way to an extent. So essentially he did a blanket pardon, promised to do different. And 5 years later, all of the monasteries and churches had been completely despoiled and all of the leaders of the revolution had been executed. But it's comparing the Pilgrimage of Grace to something that happened in the 1790s in France, which is called the Vendée. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but the Vendée was another rural, far away from Paris jurisdiction where the peasantry were outraged at what the revolutionary government was doing to their church. And it had very similarly destabilizing for the French Republican government of the 1790s, and had a very similar result of just mass murder and brutal crushing. Atatürk in the 1920s and 1930s had to deal with pro-religious uprisings. And it is just fascinating to see this extraordinary, what I see is an extraordinarily modern process playing out in the 1500s. And I think that's the main revelation that I have from my recent sort of looking into early modernity and Henry VIII is just like how far ahead of the game he was. And just sort of how shocking that is, and how it's kind of like the United States just stumbles kicks a rock and finds enough oil and gas to make us hegemonic in world oil markets again.
Tripled their wealth.
Well,
if the church had 300,000 and the government only had 100,000.
I'm not just speaking about like the dispossession. It's just the incredible series of advantages, of historical advantages that the United Kingdom might have managed to luck into are very similar to the extraordinary series of historical advantages that the United States manages to look into. Because this fat fail son of a much more competent king was incredibly greedy and wanted a divorce, the United Kingdom managed to set the trend for how do you become a powerful nation state for 500 years to come. It's how does England keep getting this goddamn lucky, it is quite something.
But also getting an Italian to teach you how to make boats is always helpful.
That's a good thing.
But that was also his father's idea.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, he seen all these Spanish and went, oh, I'd like a piece of that.
I'd like some of that.
How powerful do you believe religion is in America currently?
Incredibly powerful, but diminishing. It's diminishing to the point where even though I've gotten more progressive or left-leaning as time has gone on, I am actually old enough that I'm like, what happened to religion? Like, it's, I'm turning into a New Deal Democrat who wishes people went to church more often, despite the fact that it's incredibly hypocritical because I'm not a man of faith myself to any extent. But
do you think there was a systematic choice by the government on a much smaller scale to Henry VIII? What do you think reduces the power of the church?
It's kind of the opposite in some way. So I think what led to the incredible power of religion in the United States is in part, actually, it comes very much out of the sort of Tudor era and the Stuart era after them, and the incredible vigor of religious contention. I mean, in some ways, you have sects in the United States that are still arguing over stuff that they were arguing about 500 years ago, where nobody in Europe or the UK cares anymore. But mostly the main thing that the founding fathers did very well, and I think that the founding fathers were, I rebel against it, but you know, many of them were fairly religious, fairly Christian and folks. The incredible brilliant thing they did was engineer a separation between church and state, which allowed church to flourish. I think this is controversial, but I think the main reason that there are many reasons why the church is falling flat on its face in the United States. The churches have been falling flat on their face in the United States over the past 40, 50 years. I would say the main reason is the Republican Party's choice to make religion as partisan coded as it is now.
Similar to environmentalism, how it's sort of seen as more of a Democrat thing and it's sort of politicized when it should be more neutral.
Oh yeah, I think that's a very solid point. But I think whether or not to attend a church is something that usually I think most couples make when they're having kids, and people are having kids a lot later. Sort of a chicken and the egg thing there. You know, if you're like, oh, you know, I was raised in the church. I think Sunday school, good morals, this thing. I think that's cool. That's cool. But oh my God, like. That's associated with like Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. These people are monsters. Of course, I'm not going to do that. And earlier figures, you know, the Jerry Falwells and Pat Robertson.
Even though Donald Trump isn't very good at quoting the Bible, if you've ever seen video of it.
Well, and also I think blaming Trump for this is a kind of long after.
Oh yes, but he does wash himself in it, even if he doesn't believe any of it. Because I remember seeing a lot of people when he first won saying, it's great to have God back in the house. And I was like, I think Obama might know more about religion than this man.
Oh, I'm 100% sure he does. I mean, and really, like Republican politics, it is fascinating that it was just to link Christianity. And this has happened many, many times over history. I mean, Christianity, like Islam, is largely a blank slate. It's a pile of medieval poetry that you can make whatever political hay with you want. Just the really concrete attachment of the Republican Party to an ideology of hate. You can talk about the LGBTQ and the abortion stuff. That's not actually what I'm talking about. The war on women, blah blah blah. Not that I want to minimize that. What it is is fundamentally, the point of the Republican Party for the past 40 years has been like the poor suck, the poor are evil, the poor are lazy, the poor are stupid. The poor are people who choose to do crimes and not be rich like us. The poor are dumb and evil. That's the message of the hyper-Christian members of the Republican Party for the past 40 years.
Doesn't sound very Christian.
You know, it doesn't strike me as that way either, Rory. But what do I know? I'm not, I haven't made...
Was a lot of this backlash to communism because they were quite famously godless?
I'm not entirely certain, on how that all plays together. And I'm prepared to talk about Henry VIII today, Rory. You know, not U.S. political stuff. Henry VIII is a tremendously significant figure, not just because of his brutishness and monstrousness, but because he really changed Britain in ways that set it up for later dominance and extraordinary success. And what's really important to emphasize here, and I'm not sure if I emphasized that earlier, is how weak England was in the time of the Tudors. In the early 1400s and the 1300s, during the era of sort of the Hundred Years' War, England took over most of France. Henry V, I think, did take over the vast majority of France. You know, that was a truly massive European actor and power. Unfortunately, his son Henry VI, who this was an unfortunate long reign, was apparently quite incapable and lost most of it, and was such a mess that the country fell into civil war that you know, is still inspiring HBO prestige television 500 years later, Game of Thrones. And the Tudors really were scrabbling to recover from that. And honestly, if it weren't for the religious strife that took over all of Europe in the 1500s, and also, of course, the Turks being at the peak of their power, if it weren't for all those distractions, it's possible to imagine another 1500s conquest of a new 1066 in the 1500s. But the Tudors were able to skate by that, and crucially, vitally, they set the country up to be more powerful, more secure in the future. And I, you know, I don't even know how intentional that was, but it is something that happened. And I think it's absurd to go back to the 1500s to look for modern models. But I do think it's an interesting lesson that without appearing to be powerful, while being at some of the weakest points in its pre-modern or modern history, the English were able to set themselves up for not just regional dominance, but world dominance in just a few short centuries. And I think it's an indication of what countries are capable of when they focus on themselves rather than constantly going abroad and seeking out things to complain about and things to other folks to blame. And this isn't just like a United States thing. Like I've said over and over, and I probably need to spend more time actually putting out content on what specifically I'd like to see. But the United States has it very much in its power to purely, through domestic changes, ensure its dominance for centuries to come. And I don't think that would be a bad thing. You know, as an American, perhaps you might have a different sense as a European. It's internal changes. It's internal revolutions that set you up for security and power going forward. And it's not just the United States. I do think this is controversial, and I'm sure many would disagree with me, but I do think that since 1945, we have been in a position where most countries in the world have had an unprecedented, almost England-like freedom from external predation. And I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, well, everybody should be doing better than they are. And it's you know, it's Africa's fault they're having trouble, which is not what I'm saying at all. But I am saying that, like, as a possibility, in the decades to come, many countries can use, if they focus on themselves rather than, you know, external grievances, they can set themselves up for broader security and prosperity the way that this murderous psycho did all the way back in the 1500s for England.
So your focus isn't on raiding monasteries?
No, I think that's, who knows? Who knows what needs to be raided, Rory? Who knows what needs to be...
Oh my goodness.
who knows what needs to be changed? But I don't think there's any question in anybody's mind. Been having these conversations more and more. It's just we're ready for the next paradigm. We don't know what it is. Like, we have, I think we're seeing vague outlines of it in some aspects of the Biden administration. Some things that Trump talked about, but not, we're seeing very little in practice. We're seeing, and we certainly don't have...
Henry the Seventh figure?
Well, Henry the Seventh figure, I mean, what country wouldn't benefit from the Henry the Seventh figure? I mean, talk about an end to polarization. I think that the Wars of the Roses had lasted for decades, and Henry the Seventh ended them. I'm not calling for a brutal strongman. I think we're past that phase of history. But I do think there's scope for a leader with some better ideas to win some elections in Europe, in the United States, in China, everywhere, really. I guess they don't have elections in China, but yeah.
One bit of China they do.
In Hong Kong? Or Taiwan?
Taiwan.
Yeah.
Well, they sort of do in China, but...
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and we'll hear from you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.